Welcome to Ovarian Cancer Update. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. I met with Dr. Robert Berger, and to begin, he commented on one of the most important clinical research data sets presented in ovarian cancer in the past year, the Phase 3 AURELIA study presented at ASCO looking at the addition of bevacizumab to chemotherapy in advanced disease.
These are patients that had platinum-resistant recurrent disease that was measurable and was not a subset of patients that had been previously explored in Phase 3 studies of biologic agents in the past, and examined bevacizumab in combination with a standard single-agent cytotoxic drug in comparison to standard single-agent cytotoxic therapy alone, with a primary endpoint of progression-free survival. And essentially, these are patients that are at high risk for early disease progression and death from disease, and demonstrated a greater than 50% improvement in outcome in terms of progression-free survival. And so this is the fourth example of a Phase 3 trial that's been conducted in patients with epithelial ovarian cancer, now two in the recurrent disease setting and two in the primary disease setting, showing this phenomenon. Of course, the overall survival data are immature at this point, but I think it's encouraging. And it builds on this theme that perhaps patients that have recurrent disease or who have advanced disease at high risk of early progression and death from disease may be the subset of patients that actually benefit the most.
Now, you mentioned the other two prior trials, and of course, one of those was your study that was first presented at ASCO and then published in the New England Journal last December, the GOG-218 trial. Can you talk about that? And I think you presented some new data on that at the ASCO meeting, looking further into that. And then the other, I guess, similar trial, the ICON study.
Well, yeah, the GOG-218 trial was a frontline Phase 3 double-blind placebo-controlled trial evaluating bevacizumab in patients who had stage 3 and 4 disease established by an upfront surgery with maximal attempted cytoreduction, and examined bevacizumab in combination with chemotherapy during the chemotherapy phase of treatment alone, as well as bevacizumab with chemotherapy and then extended for a maximal total length of 10 months after completion of chemotherapy, and demonstrated a 28% reduction in the risk of progressive disease only in patients receiving bevacizumab extended beyond chemotherapy. The ICON 7 trial was a sister trial performed mostly in Western Europe, which was an open-label trial that resembled the extended bevacizumab arm of GOG-218 and the control arm of GOG-218 with the same primary endpoint, and bevacizumab continued to a maximum time of 7 months beyond the completion of chemotherapy, and demonstrated a significant improvement in progression-free survival statistically, but included a patient population that was a more broad patient population. There were many patients with high-risk early-stage disease or patients with completely resected stage 3 disease, which was completely different from the GOG-218 population, which included only patients with incompletely resectable stage 3 disease or stage 4 disease. So in the intent-to-treat population in ICON 7, the magnitude of benefit for progression-free survival was less so than in GOG-218, but there was an important subset analysis of the one-third of patients in ICON 7 who had either suboptimally debulked stage 3 disease or stage 4 disease. That was about 465 patients that demonstrated a much more robust impact on progression-free survival and, in fact, even a statistically significant improvement in overall survival in that subset. And again, that was an exploratory analysis, but it suggests that patients with higher risk disease may, in fact, benefit more. And that kind of goes along the lines of what we think about in terms of anti-angiogenic therapy in general, that the more highly angiogenic tumors are likely to be more biologically aggressive. And we see a very similar trend throughout the studies suggesting this type of pattern. So our best biologic, if you will, marker of potential benefit is probably the aggressiveness of the tumor, which is in a way represented as a surrogate of stage and volume of disease.
What's the current view of these data? You know, one of the issues that's been out there, particularly in the earlier studies, including the GOG study, is the issue about survival benefit or lack of it. And, you know, you look across the cancer center at what's going on in breast cancer, and you see that it's not available now, and because it never demonstrated survival benefit. What's the thinking and the discussions right now in the ovarian cancer community?
Well, in the ovarian cancer world, of course, it's a double-edged sword. On one hand, I think we have been able to push the overall survival curve out for patients with advanced disease, such that the median overall survival for patients with stage 3 and 4 disease is now like 4 to 5 years. So we've shifted that curve to the right without improving the cure fraction. And of course, diseases that have long post-progression-free survivals after a first regimen are subject to a problem like we see in breast cancer and in ovarian cancer, where it's becoming more difficult to demonstrate an impact of a given regimen on overall survival, even if one exists. And in the GOG trial in particular, this was a problem because bevacizumab was commercially available and used widely in patients with recurrent disease and was actually listed as a preferred regimen by NCCN for the management of recurrent disease while the trial was being conducted. So there is the potential for a crossover effect in GOG 218. We don't really see that in ICON 7. If you look at the intent to treat analysis of overall survival in ICON 7, which was conducted in a region of the world where anti-VEGF therapy was not widely available and where there's less likely to be a crossover effect, there is some separation in the overall survival curves, about 15% difference, which was not statistically significant. But again, in this subset of patients with advanced disease, there was a significant effect size on overall survival, even though it was not a pre-planned analysis. But I think there have been multiple studies demonstrating that with diseases that have long survival times post-progression, that there's a dilutional effect on overall survival, and it becomes statistically very difficult without having trials that have thousands of patients in each arm to demonstrate that there's actually an impact on overall survival. So the gynecologic cancer intergroup, which is a conglomerate of all the cooperative groups that deal with gynecologic malignancies worldwide, has essentially issued a consensus statement that progression-free survival is perhaps a preferred primary endpoint for frontline trials for patients with newly diagnosed ovarian cancer. And as long as the trials are powered to at least evaluate overall survival and demonstrate no negative impact.
Where do you see bevacizumab fitting in right now outside a trial setting in ovarian cancer? I mean, in patients who are not going to go on a study, are there situations where you think it ought to be used?
Well, I think that there's no one given clinical scenario where I think we should preferentially use bevacizumab. I think there were actually several that I would consider. One is for any patient with recurrent disease that's measurable and or symptomatic. Patients with newly diagnosed advanced disease that is incompletely resected, I think those patients should at least know the data from the two phase 3 trials in the frontline setting so they can make an educated decision. As far as, you know, the balance between potential benefit and risk, I think it should be introduced as an option.
And in terms of what we know about risk of bevacizumab and ovarian cancer, where are we, particularly with these recent trials, in terms of issues like bowel perforation?
Well, obviously, this has been a concern historically. Thus far, with the phase 3 trials, the rates of GI perforation and fistulas seem to be fairly low compared to the control groups. So the overall risk in the phase 3 trials in the women receiving bevacizumab is 3% or less. And in the control groups, they vary, but they're usually in the range of 1% to 1.5%. So there is a difference for sure, but it's of a low magnitude, and it seems to be a reasonable risk considering the potential benefit.
So we also have the issue out there, question mark, in terms of arteriovenous complications, atherogenic complications, cardiovascular disease. What do we know about this? Of course, this is an issue, hypertension, you know, in every solid tumor where bevacizumab is used. What do we know about that right now in ovarian cancer? And how does that risk vary by age?
Well, it's a very good question. I think just as we discussed for GI perforation, in women who don't have major risk factors, the rates of complications that are vascular disease related seems to be low. So as long as one's kind of acting within the guidelines set forth in the eligibility criteria of these protocols, right now what we know, for example, in GOG 218, 23% of women who were enrolled to the extended bevacizumab cohort developed hypertension that required some form of medical management, so CTC grade 2 or higher. And the proportion of patients in that group who had bevacizumab discontinued because of hypertension was 5%. So the majority of patients who developed hypertension, this could be managed while on studying, that was not a reason for discontinuation of therapy. The rates of arterial and venous thrombotic events were not significantly higher in the bevacizumab cohorts compared to the control group. I think numerically, there are slightly greater number of events in the bevacizumab-treated group, which is similar to what we've seen in phase 3 trials in women with metastatic non-gynecologic malignancies, but there's no new safety signal there. And the other phase 3 trials of bevacizumab in ovarian primary peritoneal fallopian tube cancer reflect the same type of toxicity data related to vascular disease.
So in terms of age, though, as a specific issue, in a patient who's never had a cardiovascular event, is there an age where, you know, you kind of pull back 80, 85, 90, the use of bevacizumab?
Well, obviously they're at higher risk, but without a prior history, they would have been considered eligible. So there was no specific subset analysis done, to my knowledge, related to vascular complications as a function of age. But to my knowledge, the major risk factors would be a recent event, either a cerebrovascular event or a coronary arterial vascular event. And the eligibility criteria restricted that to a 6-month period of time. Although in reality, based on probably some selection bias on the parts of investigators, I would imagine patients with prior myocardial infarction or prior stroke were excluded just on the basis of being selected out.
Is there a clinical syndrome where you're more likely to want to think about bevacizumab? And the one that I have heard about in the past is the patient with ascites.
That's a great question. The theory at this time is that vascular endothelial growth factor, which was formerly known as vascular permeability factor, is overexpressed in the majority of these tumors and may in fact be the major explanation for the observation of malignant ascites and pleural effusions in this disease. And anecdotally, we do see these patients, their ascites and pleural effusions go away as a harbinger of a response or stabilization of disease. But there was no formal analysis that I'm aware of within the phase 3 trials looking at whether patients who presented with ascites as a clinical marker seemed to have an improved outcome. I think it would be an important analysis to do, though.
So you wrote a great review article on gynecologic oncology, overview of anti-angiogenic agents and development for ovarian cancer. Without going through every single detail of this great paper, I thought maybe you could just sort of globally take a step back and comment, you know, on some of the issues that you talked about. Beginning with, I always like people to take shots at explaining pathways and biology, and you have some cool graphics and ideas in here. Again, for a doc in practice trying to keep up with a lot of different pathways, what are some of the issues, the targets out there in terms of angiogenesis, and where are we in terms of understanding how these agents even work?
Well, we could spend a lot of time on this. I think to try to simplify it, there are two phases of angiogenesis in tumors. One is the initiation phase, which is generally the formation of an immature vascular network that is promoted by the release of growth factors such as VEGF into the tumor microenvironment. And the second phase is the maturation phase, where you actually form stable microvascular networks that are functional. And that process is governed by a set of other growth factors, including platelet-derived growth factor, angiopoietin, which govern vascular remodeling and the coverage of immature endothelial networks by parasites and smooth muscle cells. And so anti-angiogenic therapy involves the implementation of agents that block both of those phases of angiogenesis. And VEGF is implicated primarily in the initiation phase, which is why one of the byproducts is sort of a pseudo-normalization of the microvasculature and pruning of endothelial networks. But there are a number of agents that are in development. There are multi-targeted oral tyrosine kinase inhibitors that block signal transduction of the VEGF receptor, the platelet-derived growth factor receptor, the fibroblast growth factor receptor. And those are sort of dirty bombs because they affect probably the initiation and maturation phase. And one of the questions is whether multi-targeting is a better solution, because you may be able to bypass some of the potential resistance mechanisms that could be a consequence of blocking only one pathway or one growth factor, such as with a pure anti-VEGF strategy, i.e. bevacizumab. AMG 386 is a novel agent which actually binds to angiopoietins and blocks its interaction with the Tie-2 receptor and prevents vascular remodeling, and is another potential method. And agents from both of these groups have been studied in phase 2 trials and are now in phase 3 studies in patients with newly diagnosed and recurrent ovarian cancer, but we don't have any data from these trials yet, and there are several of them that are maturing as we speak. So in clinical practice right now, I think it's probably premature to answer the question, how do we implement agents that cover the various phases of angiogenesis? There's a lot more that we need to learn from the initial phase 3 studies. And then what's going to be really important is developing experimental models to understand how these agents interact with each other, whether they should be used in sequence. And the beauty is that the maturation inhibitors and the initiation inhibitors have non-overlapping adverse events profiles. So theoretically, they can be used and play together in the same sandbox. But how they will interact overall in terms of counteracting disease progression is a big question.
So one of your tables that lists a lot of these new small molecules or TKIs that are being developed includes one we've heard about in other tumors, cediranib, and another BIBF-1120. Any comments about those specific agents?
Well, BIBF-1120 is now in phase 3. It certainly has demonstrated single-agent activity in phase 2 studies. It's now undergoing phase 3 investigation in frontline therapy, much in the way that GOG-218 studied bevacizumab, but in a two-arm double-blind placebo-controlled trial, which is maturing. I think it's close to enrollment and maturing at this point. And then cediranib is being studied in the platinum-sensitive recurrent disease setting, first relapse, in a three-arm placebo-controlled trial that looks like GOG-218 transposed to platinum-sensitive recurrent disease.
Now, these types of TKIs, do they have a similar sort of on-target toxicity profile in terms of hypertension, et cetera?
Well, you see this, it's more variable, and I think that reflects probably biodistribution issues. But you do see additional effects where you actually will know who's getting what, and usually manifested by dermatitis and more gastrointestinal mucosal acute effects, like diarrhea and stomatitis, which you don't tend to see with pure anti-VEGF agents. So it's actually very difficult to perform a placebo-controlled trial with these agents because you tend to know based on these non-traditional side effects that you would see with pure anti-VEGF therapy, you tend to know who's on a placebo and who's getting active drug.
Anything else that happened at ASCO or that's come out recently in ovarian cancer that's exciting?
Well, it was a reconfirmation. I think the update of the Japanese GOG study, which randomized patients with advanced disease to standard schedule paclitaxel with carboplatin versus dose-dense weekly paclitaxel with carboplatin, showing preservation of an overall survival advantage and progression-free survival advantage, is encouraging. And so I think that was good. And it looks like the patients with clear cell and mucinous cancers, which fortunately are rare subtypes, don't stand to benefit really no matter what you do. And that's a dilemma. But when you filter those patients out, there's probably a greater magnitude of benefit. And this suggests that paclitaxel schedule is extremely important. And there's a confirmatory trial that's being conducted in the U.S. that closed to accrual recently, GOG 262, which essentially duplicated the design of the Japanese GOG study and has actually incorporated bevacizumab as an electable strategy. And my understanding is over 80% of patients in the GOG 262 trial received bevacizumab with either regimen.
Just out of curiosity, I mean, is it likely that bevacizumab is going to be approved in ovarian cancer, or is it being applied for?
I actually don't know what the status is at this point. I think that there's compelling evidence to allow registration of bevacizumab, but I think that the FDA is going to need to make the decision as to where it fits in terms of what they feel is approvable, because essentially, now we have four positive trials that were designed in a fashion that was peer-reviewed, and three of those are registration trials. So I think the data are compelling to allow registration, but I have no idea what the plan is.
In clinical practice, is it possible or impossible to obtain bevacizumab in ovarian cancer outside a trial?
Oh, absolutely. It's been used for years. But as I said earlier, the NCCN has listed bevacizumab as a preferred agent in the management of patients with recurrent disease for many years, even when the frontline trials were being conducted. And so it's been used widely in the United States. It's actually very difficult to obtain bevacizumab in some states and with some insurance plans. So from that standpoint, it has been kind of a discriminatory process, which is why I think it needs to be approved in order to level the playing field and allow access to be more uniform. It's been difficult in general to treat patients in the frontline setting without an approval, but there are some patients that have been supported in the use of bevacizumab and where it's been covered in the frontline setting. Again, those are sporadic cases.
Yeah, you know, it's one thing, I think, to add bevacizumab to chemo in the frontline setting, but it's another to consider it as a single agent, which you don't very much in other tumors, for example, breast cancer, and know that there are patients out there, I'm sure there's some in your practice, you can identify who got Bev monotherapy and clinically benefited.
Absolutely. And in the recurrent disease setting, other than a patient with platinum-sensitive recurrent disease, who I'm actually looking for, and again, I'm looking for a distinct effect. So the way I look at the implementation of cytotoxic therapy in patients with advanced Müllerian duct cancers is I'm actually going after the tumor component. And if I can push progression-free survival and overall survival time out to the right, targeting the tumor compartment with cytotoxic therapy, that's great. And so I have to think about that decision separate for my use of an anti-angiogenic agent, which I think is principally directed at the tumor microenvironment, meaning the host side of the tumor, which will tend to be genetically more stable and recapitulate the same process once the agent is discontinued. So in my mind, it's almost like the anti-angiogenic agent is implemented as a prison guard, which can shut off local proliferation, invasion, and metastasis in a much different way than a cytotoxic agent, which is essentially having more of a direct anti-tumor effect. I'm not sure whether they actually have to be combined. There's experimental data in animal models that suggest an improvement in delivery of simultaneously administered systemic agents in the presence of an anti-angiogenic agent, or there may be some instances where synergy has been demonstrated in preclinical models, but I'm not sure that it's a critical element in treating humans with cancer.
So let's talk about your cases, beginning with your 55-year-old lady.
Of course. So this patient is 55 years old, had the typical types of abdominal complaints, and was found to have extensive intra-abdominal tumor involving likely the omentum in association with ascites. So when we evaluate patients based on examination and imaging, we have to factor in whether we're dealing with an extensive diffuse process with evidence of, let's say, carcinomatous ileus miliary disease versus relatively isolated advanced disease. And I think that putting that together with functional status and medical comorbidities helps us to make a decision as to whether an upfront surgery to make a diagnosis and manage that disease is the correct decision. So in this case, I think the decision for her to have an upfront surgery made sense. And in fact, she underwent an exploratory laparotomy, including hysterectomy, bilateral salpingostectomy, omentectomy, and tumor debulking. And when we explored her, she had multifocal disease in the abdomen, including the omental metastases, bilateral ovarian surface disease. Her largest area of tumor was a confluent mass in the omentum. So at the end of the day, when we were done with surgery, which was about 3.5 to 4 hours, she had a few areas of disease that were less than 2 millimeters, high up under the diaphragm near the hepatic vein, which is a very sort of a treacherous area to operate. And we're never going to completely resect these diseases in the radical sense so that there's nothing left to treat. So I think that you have to exercise your clinical judgment at that point. And so the surgery was completed at that point, and her pathology showed a high-grade serous adenocarcinoma involving all those structures. So I had a discussion with her after she successfully recovered within a couple of weeks about where to go next. And I often consider, of course, platinum taxane combination chemotherapy is considered standard, but there are several ways to spin platinum taxane combination chemotherapy in a patient with optimally debulked stage 3 disease. And so we discussed three basic options. One is to implement the dose-dense paclitaxel regimen based on the results of the JGOG phase 3 trial that we discussed earlier. Even though we don't have a confirmatory trial, I think that those data are compelling, and it makes sense in terms of biologic plausibility that we would, if anything, not make matters worse. And in our experience with this regimen, which is very, very commonplace now, patients actually tolerate it even better than the usual regimen, especially in terms of the typical spectrum of and severity of adverse events related to paclitaxel.
And just to clarify, how long have you been using this dose dense?
Really, since we saw the results of the JGOD trial, the actual manuscript publication.
When was that?
I think it was about a year ago.
Okay.
We also discussed the combination of intraperitoneal and intravenous therapy. There have been three randomized trials of intraperitoneal intravenous combination therapy versus intravenous therapy alone in patients with advanced disease, demonstrating survival advantages. These trials were not pure in the sense that there were potentially other explanations for a survival advantage that muddied the water and make some non-believers in terms of the route of administration being important. And I think the best example of this is the trial that demonstrated the most significant impact on overall survival and is the most contemporary trial, GOG-172, which compared intravenous cisplatin and paclitaxel with intraperitoneal cisplatin, intraperitoneal paclitaxel, and IV paclitaxel, and demonstrated a 16-month median overall survival advantage, which was highly significant for the experimental group. But again, if you look at the design of the trial, The experimental regimen included a day 8 paclitaxel administration and included a 25% higher dose of cisplatin in the experimental regimen. So it's difficult to know which factor contributed most, but my sense is the frequency of paclitaxel administration could have potentially explained the impact on overall survival as we saw in the Japanese GOG trial. But still, I think it's worth discussing with patients. That is an approach. And then we also talked about anti-angiogenic therapy with bevacizumab combined with carboplatin and paclitaxel, a la GOG 218 and ICON 7, with bevacizumab extended to at least disease progression based on the results of the OCEANS trial, which we didn't really talk about today. But I think, again, if an anti-angiogenic agent is going to be effective, it really doesn't make any sense once you initiate therapy to stop therapy at a specific point in time when there's no evidence of progression, as long as there are no unacceptable adverse effects. I was a little less enthusiastic about bevacizumab in this situation because the extent of residual disease was minimal. And again, I really believe that the patients that stand to benefit the most are the patients with less resectable tumors, which are biologically more aggressive. But we did talk about these three options, and she ultimately chose the dose-dense regimen.
And what's her current status?
Well, she's in the midst of her primary therapy and doing well.
Let's finish out talking about your 82-year-old lady. I'm always interested about management of older patients, particularly in a difficult disease like this, which has some challenging treatment options. Can you kind of just briefly talk about how she presented and what happened?
Sure. Well, this patient is, as you said, 82. She had had a previous hysterectomy many years ago for benign disease and presented with abdominal swelling over a less than 1 month period, had a CT scan that demonstrated ascites, thickening of the omentum, and a right lower quadrant mass that measured about 7 centimeters in diameter. She underwent a paracentesis before seeing me, where about 3 liters of ascites was aspirated and had cytology performed, which was consistent with a high-grade serous adenocarcinoma. She had significant fatigue over several months. Decreased appetite was probably about 40% at her normal nutritional intake and had, you know, some compromise in her performance status.
Was it your sense that she was sort of well before this?
Yes. So she was well before this, but she had a significant impact on her nutrition. You could tell just based on her physical examination that she had some muscle wasting, and her performance status was probably an ECOG 2.
What was her lifestyle like before she kind of deteriorated?
Very active, doing all the things she wanted to do in life. And
was she a very motivated patient? It was, you know, sort of saying, hey, let's try everything, or more backing off?
Actually very motivated and wanted to be aggressive. Her concept was that she was feeling otherwise well. She felt that at least in terms of the primary treatment period, she wanted to be aggressive because we do know that these patients can derive several years of benefit even with a primary regimen if you happen to find the right key that fits the lock and you don't know it before you try. So
it looks like her treatment was pretty interesting. I'm not sure if this was what would have happened in the community, but what did happen with her?
Well, we happened to be studying the feasibility and safety of implementing bevacizumab in the context of neoadjuvant chemotherapy. It's actually a 3-institution trial that's being conducted at Fox Chase Cancer Center, Columbia, and the University of Virginia, examining bevacizumab in the context of neoadjuvant chemotherapy prior to interval surgery. And so she elected to enroll onto this trial. And the design is such that the treatment cycles that include bevacizumab are the ones that are not approximate to the planned interval surgery. So in other words, bevacizumab is held during the cycle just before planned interval surgery and the cycle immediately after surgery. So thus far, she's received 3 cycles of neoadjuvant chemotherapy, 2 of those cycles, including bevacizumab, and had a near complete response clinically and radiographically So at this point, her plan is to go forth with an interval surgery. And the way the trial is designed, interestingly, is that there are 6 additional cycles of chemotherapy, 5 with bevacizumab, so a total of 9 cycles of carboplatin and paclitaxel.
Any situations where you might want to hold off on surgery? Suppose she was older or more comorbidities?
Yeah, I think that there are patients for whom surgery really, you know, might not make a lot of sense. I think if you have a patient who has stage 4 disease with parenchymal liver metastasis, that's fairly extensive, parenchymal lung disease, which is extremely rare, and you should really think twice about the diagnosis if you see that. Those are situations where I think you'd be hard-pressed to say that you would have a significant impact on overall survival by operating on a patient like that. And certainly if you have contraindications based on severe cardiopulmonary disease, a patient who's receiving neoadjuvant chemotherapy demonstrating minimal to no response or progressing through neoadjuvant chemotherapy, certainly I don't think it would make any sense to go forward with an interval surgery in that situation.
You know, sort of just looking at her globally, I mean, if her neighbors sort of watched her go back and forth, is her overall functioning and quality of life better, worse, or the same since she started treatment?
Well, what's interesting is that she's somewhat better in terms of her performance status. I think that the treatment was associated with significant fatigue, but her performance status has improved to a level 1. Her nutrition is obviously improved based on physical examination and based on her history. She's able to eat and drink without any problems now. She's getting around better. Her muscle wasting is gone. She doesn't have any peripheral edema, which was a problem. I think these patients get, with the development of extensive ascites, it creates a protein sink, essentially, and they tend to get the third space in other areas, actually. So you see a lot of peripheral edema, some cachexia, and you can reverse a lot of this, and you can get the ship to float better before thinking about a surgical procedure.